Accession number 29054, Mr. Bim Wells, Reel 11. Now, we're talking about you flew back into Australia. Now, tell me about that. Where did you land? Because you left the ship and flew in.
I don't think I was one of the air crew who actually flew off the ship. As we approached Sydney Harbour, the aircraft were flown ashore to an airfield near Sydney called Schofields.
Schofields?
Yeah. I seem to remember I was still on board as we steamed into, the fleet steamed into Sydney Harbour. I mean, there was the Implacable, the Formidable, the Victorious. We'd left the Indefatigable up in Japan. And I know our squadron diary recorded on, I think it was the 24th of August, that the fleet sailed proudly into Sydney Harbour and was well received by the natives, which I thought was...
What do you remember? I mean, did they make a fuss of you when you...
We did. I mean, we tied up at Woolloomooloo Docks in Sydney, and I remember Charles Evans saying, any air crew who are found on this ship after another hour will be forcibly thrown ashore. He said, go and paint the town red light. You deserve it. Or words to that effect.
And what do you remember? What did you do when you got ashore?
I think I got drunk as far as the thing was, in Australia in those days, the licensing laws were impossible. They opened the bars for an hour between, I think, 5 and 6 at night, and then they shut them. That was it. So you went into a bar, and they were not like our pubs. It was real sort of spit and sawdust type things, and there were people 3 deep at a bar, and there were perhaps 3 or 4 barmaids or barmen, and all they did for an hour was to go up and down serving beer, and if you hadn't emptied your pint pot by the time they came, you missed it. So, you know, in an hour you'd probably drunk 4 pints of fairly strong Australian beer, and I never could drink beer very much, and I seem to remember I got fairly drunk anyway, and I eventually staggered back on board ship. And but we were then I was then sent out to Schofields field, where we were by this time starting to receive some of the Avenger 3s, and we had a course on those. And
now, what were they like?
Well,
the Avenger, as compared to the Avenger 2 and 1 you talked about already?
There were a number of not big refinements, but they were they got better radar, they got a bit more power in the engine, and they were generally a better aircraft. By this time, Alan Swanton, our CO, who had been on active service for most of the war anyway, had been sent back to England. I don't know on which ship he went, but our new CO was a chap named Bobby Bradshaw, who was a bit of a Fleet Air Arm legend.
Tell us about him. What was famous about him? What was he like?
He'd got DSO, DSC and bar, I think. Youngish chap in early 20, about 24.
A lieutenant commander.
Yeah, lieutenant commander.
Why was he famous?
One incident I remember in his career, he was on board a carrier called the Nabob. I think this was off Norway. And the Nabob was hit by a U-boat, torpedoed, and it developed a very strong list, either port or starboard, and the weather had closed in, and Bobby Bradshaw volunteered to take off from this listing carrier to try and find a U-boat that had torpedoed the Nabob, and he flew around for a couple of hours trying to find this thing, and by the time he got back to the ship it was more or less covered in fog, and he made his approach through this fog and managed to, it was more or less a crash landing on the Nabob. I think he cleared up four parked aircraft and in the tower, but I think that was one of the incidents where he was awarded the DSC. But
now, what was he like?
He was a very charismatic chap, unlike Alan Swanton, who was straight Navy, RN. Bobby was RNVR, and as it were, he was one of the lads. He was an extremely good pilot, and as long as you did what you were supposed to do, he was very, very sociable, very nice chap. He used to take us out to these nightclubs in Sydney, and I remember one of his sort of party pieces when he had had a few drinks was to get three chairs, one on top of two, and then he'd do a handstand on the top chair and then tell you to take one of the other chairs away. So he was balancing upside down on his hands. And that's the sort of chap he was. He was really a charismatic chap, and he got a wonderful reputation in the Fleet Air Arm. And what he wanted to do as part of the celebrations for the end of the war was to fly the whole squadron under Sydney Harley Bridge in formation. And
now what happened about that? Was it done?
Well, I don't know whether he actually did it. I certainly wasn't with him when he did, but I've been down to see his sister, who was a wonderful character, who was a Wren officer, and she and her husband live at a place called Tree Bar Gardens, which is near to Falmouth in Cornwall, and when I was down there on holiday, I wrote to her and went to see her, and she was selling cards in the shop at Tree Bar Gardens of her brother flying under Sydney Harbour Bridge giving the V sign. Now, I've spoken to several chaps in my squadron, particularly at these reunions that we've had, and none of them were ever a part of a formation that flew under Sydney Harbour Bridge. But
so he might have done it on his
he
own.
He might have done it, and of course he would have been court-martialed, but they reckon they could never find out who had done it. But I've got no real grounds for deciding whether that story was true or not, but
now, what was the setup at Schofield Airfield? That's near Sydney. What's happening? Well, I mean, where were you living? What were you doing?
It was shortly after we got these Avenger 3s. We then went down to another airfield called Nowra, which is about 70 miles south of Sydney, and we were still doing
Nowra,
N-O-W-R-A, Nowra, and that was a single strip airfield, we'd still got Reg Elliott, our senior pilot, with us, because he said, I'm going to appoint you a squadron sports and welfare officer, you see, because I don't know why, whether it's to keep me out of trouble or what. But
now, what was your job as sports and welfare officer?
Well, I was told to go and see the Australian Army Amenities place in Sydney, and I went over there, and they said, well, what do you want, you see? I said, well, we're playing quite a bit of tennis over there at Nowra, and we've got a squadron football team, and they said, they gave me a load of tennis rackets, footballs, and all sorts of things like that, and I took those back because one of our observers used to get me up at about 6:30 in the morning to go and play him tennis before breakfast. And sometimes I wasn't really in a very good condition to do that. But The other thing I did whilst we're at Nowra was to run a squadron dance in the arts centre in Nowra. And again, I went into Sydney because the Implacable was still there. It was having a refit and so on in Woolloomooloo docks, and I went and saw the number one, that's the commander, he was called number one, he was the exec commander, and I said, I'm the squadron, 808 squadron sports and welfare officer, and we're, as you know, down at Nowra now, and I want to run a dance for the ground crew and everybody else in the squadron, and can I have a donation from the ship's funds? So I said, yes, I think so, my boy, how about £250? I said, well, I said, I think that'll cover it. And so I went down and booked this hall, and of course the lads in the squadron said, what about girls? We want some girls if we're going to have a dance. And I arranged, I think, three coach loads of girls from outlying towns to come into this dance. And we got a load of beer in, and we decorated all this hall up. I took a lorry load of ratings down, and we decorated it all up. And we had a whale of a time, really. Quite a few of the ratings finished up being very drunk, and the girls had a good time, and we put them all back on the buses, and off they went. And those were the sort of things, I suppose, I did, really. And but we were still doing a lot of flying even then.
Now, what type of flying were you doing? Were you just getting used to the Avenger 3, or what exactly were you doing?
I did we did cross low level cross country navigation. By that, if we weren't sure where we were, we used to fly low past a railway station and read the name. And there were one or two reports or complaints about low flying and so on. And
these were just practice flights, weren't they?
Well, still doing quite a bit of formation flying. We went on another link training course in Sydney, and another incident I remember is that one of the ratings in the squadron drowned off Sydney doing surfing, and they had a sort of military funeral, and I was detailed as officer of the day, as it were, to go along to this funeral with another chap who was the squadron's engineer officer. And it was quite dusty around, you know, it was, they'd had a long dry summer, and we went to this funeral service. And the cemetery was some miles out of Sydney, and Dennis Lamb, who was the engineer officer, and I, we were in khakis, but we took our white number ones to put on just for the service and that. And we went and saw this poor chap off, and we went back into the sort of building that was at the cemetery to change back into khakis. And by the time we came out, all the ratings who had formed the firing party had got onto the lorry and gone back to Sydney and left us two there. And it was sort of miles out of Sydney, and the only thing that was left was the undertakers with the hearse. And we said, can you give us a lift back into Sydney? He said, well, as you can see, there's three of us who are going to fill the front seat, but if you want to sit in the back of the hearse on the rollers, like, you can do. So they took us back into Sydney in this hearse, and there's Dennis and I sitting on and sort of going like this to the people as we're going through the centre of Sydney. And
waving.
Yeah. It's the only time I've travelled in the back of a hearse in that manner. But
Now, you said that you'd had some reaction to your actual active serving, you know, the strikes. Yeah. What was the nature of the reaction you had?
I started passing blood, actually. And that worried me. I noticed I was getting, I wouldn't say I was twitchy, but I, you know, there was a reaction from what we'd been doing, I think. And I started getting a bit more nervous about night flying, I think, at that stage as well. I began to wonder what the point of it all was, because we were still doing night flying. And there were one or two other incidents where I remember I was taking an aircraft up and the throttle jammed, and I was flying over very rough country like brush, and the throttle was jammed and I couldn't get it wouldn't go forward, and I was heading straight towards this line of trees which were about 60 feet high, and I just couldn't get the thing, because I was only just above stalling speed, and I thought, you know, I don't know how I'm going to get out of this, and whether it, I just got hold of the, I didn't pull it back to get forward thing, otherwise it would have stalled, and I just got hold of it, and with all the strength I'd got, I managed to push it forward through this gate, and the engine roared into life, and I just cleared these trees by about 5 feet, and when I got back, I, you know, filled in these forms that you have to fill in when there's something wrong with an aircraft, but that didn't do me any good.
Was that in the night? Or was that
no,
night?
That was in the daytime, but, I mean, there was no way I could put the aircraft down and without killing myself. And as I say, if I hadn't have got the throttle through whatever was stopping it, I would have crashed into the trees, and that would have been the end of it, you know. But all so these sort of things all sort of played on me a bit. But we had to do what they call a balbo when Vian came back after the after the Japanese surrender, we did a big formation flight over Sydney.
Now tell me about
information.
That.
Well, this was I think I did about three or four of these in the end. It was all part of the celebrations in Australia for the end of the war, and we, because there weren't that many of the British Pacific Fleet squadrons left in Australia at this time. Most of them had gone home. And we were asked to do this formation flight over Sydney. I think we put something like 100 aircraft in the air, and there were Avengers and Seafires and Fireflies and some Corsairs and Hellcats, all in different squadrons, and we sort of did this flight over Sydney Harbour, over the bridge, and it was all, well, one of them was certainly for Admiral Vian. And then shortly after this, the Indefatigable by this time had come back to Sydney, and we, the Implacable, the Indefatigable, and the Glory, which was another carrier, we went on a goodwill visit to Melbourne. Three big carriers,
so you went back on board the Implacable.
Yeah.
It had had its refit.
Yeah, it? And we went down to Melbourne, and they treated.
So when, sorry, hang on. When was this about? How many months were you at Nowra and?
Well, this was round about November time of.
So about 3 months ashore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, so what happened then on this goodwill tour to Melbourne?
Well, we pulled into the docks at Melbourne, and there were There was the implacable one side of the dock, the indefatigable the other side, and the glory there. In total, there were 90. I remember the newspaper headlines said 90,000 tons of British carrier here today. And the Marines band put on a display, and we opened the ships to the public. And I was duty officer that day, and I was in the hangar with the aircraft and that, and some of these young lads were coming and asking me for my autograph, which I was a bit embarrassed about.
What did you have to do as a duty officer?
Well, we had to take parties of these civilians. They let them on the ship, and we were parties of about 12 of them, and we had to take them around the ship and show them, you know, what was what. And it was fine until one of these people said, "Can we see the engine room?" And I said, "Well, yes, I think so." Of course, I'd never been in the engine room. You know, I'd the flight deck, the hangar, the ops room, and all this sort of thing. I thought, well, all I've got to do is get into the bowels of the ship, you see. So I kept taking these 12 people down these vertical ladders, and we eventually arrived at what I thought might be the engine room, but it turned out to be the plant where they convert seawater into drinking water, which you've got to have, of course, because you use a lot of it when you're at sea. And I never did find the engine room that day. So, they put on all, each ship then decorated itself up, and they invited the dignitaries and so on in Melbourne to come on board as our guests. And I know they decorated our ship to look like a South Sea island. There were fountains and palms and food and booze, and you know, it's a wonderful occasion, really.
And this was a sort of dignity VIP party. Who was invited?
All the sort of the mayor and the council of Melbourne, all the local naval people there, and a lot of the society people of Melbourne, and they were wonderful occasions. And
how did you get on with the Australians generally? I mean, it sounds pretty good from what you said, but could you just talk a bit about how you got on with them?
Got on with them very well, those that of course a lot of their servicemen had not returned from the war at that time. I mean, the other thing I should have mentioned is that once the ship had done its refit, they cleared all the aircraft out of the hangars, and it became a hospital ship. They took about two or three dozen nurses on board, and they went north to pick up both British and Australian and New Zealand prisoners of war.
While you were on it? While you were ashore?
We were ashore.
Right, okay.
The ship went now, and did that, yeah.
No, I think because you weren't there then.
No.
So how did you get on with the Australians? How did you find them?
We found them very hospitable. Couldn't do enough for you. We went to various functions, and they got like a USO place, and you could go there, and there were invitations to go out to American families, farms, you name it. You could. There was always something there for you to do if you wanted to do it. And I got on extremely well with the Australians, I must say.
Now, so
I had one or two girlfriends there, and we used to. In fact, one of the lieutenants in the squadron was married in Australia, and we all went to his. The wedding, and that was a wonderful occasion, and we generally had a good time. We got into doing a bit of surfing and all this business, and
So what after Melbourne? I mean, you've got this big party, and you know, what happened after Melbourne?
Well, after Melbourne, I was informed by Bobby Bradshaw that my time was up, as it were, and I was to be sent home.
Now, how did you feel about leaving the ship, leaving the squadron, more to the point?
the squadron had changed quite a lot in that the old hands who had Alan Swanton and by this time Reg Elliott and most of the other people who had been in the squadron like when I joined it had been sent home already, and we'd had a lot of people, new pilots come in who hadn't had any active service at all, but they all came into the squadron and under Bobby Bradshaw, and his job was to sort of put them all together again as a squadron. And as I say, by the time we got to the end of 45, as it were, my name came up at top of the list to go home, and I was told that I was to join 820 Squadron on HMS Indefatigable, which was our sister ship. And I went on there.
And this, to go home?
Yeah, with about, I think about six more pilots from our squadron, we were all put on Indefatigable to be sent home.
And this is before Christmas, December?
I think it was just after Christmas, actually, because I'm pretty sure...
Before the new year, though?
Yeah. I think the last time I actually flew for the squadron was the 22nd of December when I did a dummy torpedo attack on the Indefatigable, actually.
I see. Now, what did you think of 820 Squadron? I mean, you were only in transit, really, weren't you?
Only on transit. We got no aircraft. I was just being sent home, and we left Melbourne, and we headed for Cape Town in South Africa. And I got a new CO, of course, and I know he got us together. There was about six of us from 828 Squadron, and said, welcome to 820 Squadron. We haven't got any aircraft. But he said, you're not on a luxury cruise, and we've got a Seafire squadron on board, and he said, you will be expected to do deck handling duties. And I remember as we approached Cape Town, the Seafire squadron on board did a formation flight over Cape Town, all again part of the cessation of the war celebrations, and on that day I was detailed to be part of the deck handling crew, and my job was, when a Seafire landed on, I was just forward of the batsman. I had to dash out, disengage the hook so he could fly forward. And about the third Seafire to land on, as he approached the flight deck, and as I say, I was about 10 feet forward of the batsman on the edge of the deck, ready to dash out, this Seafire suddenly started to drift to port. And from my experience of flying, I thought, he's not going to make it. And he suddenly, his left wing dipped, and at the same time I dived off the deck into some sort of netting at the side, and his wingtip caught the deck of the aircraft carrier, spun over the side in a flash of flame, and he'd gone and he was killed. And I thought, God, that's as near as I've come to losing my life, and I'm not flying. I'm merely deck handling. And that was in fact the last flight that was made off Indefatigable before it came back to UK.